Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a new app for mental health wellness and a plan to save the Amazon. But up front, there's a good chance you had an appointment with your doctor through telemedicine or telehealth during the pandemic. The expansion of telehealth or remote clinical care has increased by more than 150% since 2019. It's due in large part to pandemic-related policy changes, along with public necessity. Will telemedicine still be a major part of our healthcare futures afterwards? Joining us on today's program is Warren Kampf, Senior Vice President, Advocacy and External Affairs with the Hospital and Health System Association of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Hal Baker, WellSpan Health's Senior Vice President and Chief Digital Information Officer. Dr. Baker, let me start with a basic question. What is considered telehealth or telemedicine?
Good morning. Well, telehealth is both video and sometimes phone calls that replace a visit. It can also be the asynchronous communication back and forth through messaging or the submission of home collected information like blood pressures, et cetera, to allow the care to happen without the patient having to come into the office.
Does that include telephonic doctor visits, if you will?
It does, and we have been doing those, though, to a lesser extent than we've done with video in the last few months. The emergency authorizations allow us to have telephone visits for those who can't come into the office, and this has actually been a real help with some of the recent snowstorms.
Yeah, I'll bet. How much of it is being used now during the pandemic?
We are doing thousands of visits. On March 17th of 2020, we had our first diagnosis in the WellSpan system. In the weeks before that, we did 47 video visits. In the 4 weeks after, we did over 35,000. And we are doing over 38,000 in the month of January in just video visits.
Warren Kampf with the Hospital and Health System Association of Pennsylvania. You know, before the pandemic, we often heard that telemedicine or telehealth would be a significant part of healthcare in the future. Is the future now? I mean, is this something that will continue past the pandemic if we ever get out of the pandemic?
Well, Scott, absolutely it is. I mean, the future is now. On behalf of our members, basically all the hospitals of the state, but also for all medical providers, you know, we've been pushing for legislation that defines what telemedicine is, guarantees it's going to be provided by a licensed and qualified practitioner, and also guarantees that it'll be reimbursed by the payers, the government payers like Medicare, and then the private payers. The legislation has been around for a couple of sessions because our members saw the future coming. But like you said, the future is now.
And I do want to talk about that legislation because right now there is little, if any, guidelines for from the state anyway, as far as telemedicine goes. So we'll talk about that legislation in just a moment. By the way, if you have a question or a comment about telemedicine, telehealth, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Baker, I've been using the words telehealth and telemedicine interchangeably. Are they, or are they different?
I'm not sure there's a meaningful distinction. We're really just trying to connect with patients, and in this time where we have to do social distancing, making sure that it's safe and that we don't put anybody at risk of coming into a medical facility when they don't need to. We have great caution there, but people getting out, having to take a bus or anything to get to us, a video visit provides a wonderful opportunity to connect. And, you know, the great thing about it for me as a primary care doc is when I'm in a video visit, I can actually see somebody smile again. And I've been missing that in the exam room when people come into the exam room.
You know, you've just touched on a few of these things, Dr. Baker, but what are some of the advantages of telemedicine?
Well, I think convenience is one. It allows you to have a visit from home with much less time away from work. You can even do it at work if you have a private space. So there's greater convenience. There's reduced navigation and administration. We do lose the ability to do a physical exam most of the time. But in a lot of care, and especially we're seeing in behavioral health, the privacy of a video visit is providing all the connection and all the full connection of a human face to a human face that's really hard to do in the current pandemic. I do think that people who try it really tend to like it. And we're finding that 70% of our patients who've done one visit are interested in doing another. And so we really hope that the legislation and insurance regulations allow us to continue this even after the pandemic, because we think it's going to provide a really meaningful augmentation to our ability to provide care in a low cost, easy, and convenient manner, which is our mission.
Are there disadvantages?
There's certainly the disadvantages of not being able to see all of the body language of a person, but not being able to do a physical exam. Certainly, if you're having a possible case of appendicitis, a video visit is not going to make that decision. But for many parts of healthcare, such as following up on treatment of heartburn or depression, a video visit really leaves almost nothing lacking and can provide a very effective way for the doctor to have certainty and the patient to feel connected with the provider.
I noticed that you singled out behavioral health. We know that one of the challenges or hurdles for those who may be suffering from a mental illness or just an episode or maybe even depression or anxiety, that that stigma that goes along with it, that many people don't seek health. With telemedicine as an option, are you seeing more people that maybe are having some issues? They're more willing to come forward because of that privacy of telemedicine.
Well, as we look at our specialty practices, the non-primary care practices, and look at the practices that are using telehealth the most, week after week, we see that 8, 9, 10 out of 10 of our top practices using that are behavioral health practices. And I suspect that the privacy of being able to connect from home may be part of it. Both our behavioral health providers and our patients seem to be finding it very acceptable. I do hope that anything that reduces the barrier to seeking behavioral health care will continue, because we really want to try to erase that stigma and recognize that behavioral health care is equally important and needs to be as connected and compassionate as somatic health care for the body.
Do you think that maybe this will help reduce that stigma of seeking behavioral health care?
I hope it does. Certainly that you've seen a variety of apps on the television, et cetera, that are trying to offer different avenues for people who may just not be ready to take the steps of walking into a behavioral health office space. We want to make it easier for people to get care when they need it and reduce that friction and provide it in a caring, compassionate manner. And we're really finding that we can do that very well through the telehealth platform.
If you're just tuning in, our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Hal Baker, WellSpan Health Senior Vice President and Chief Digital Information Officer, and Warren Camp, Senior Vice President, Advocacy and External Affairs with the Hospital and Health System Association of Pennsylvania. We're talking about telemedicine, and apparently the future is now, something that in a lot of ways dictated by the pandemic, social distancing, not being able to visit hospitals and doctor's offices in person. person as much. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Now, Representative Camp, and I call you Representative because you're a former state legislator, there's a question from a listener, and this leads into our discussion of legislation. Amber, who is a student at Millersville University, says, if we continue to do telehealth appointments, will insurance companies continue to pay for it? And that leads into our discussion, but what about Amber's question?
Sure. So to Amber and your listeners, I mean, as it currently stands right now, the reports we get from our members, from the hospitals and health systems of the state, you know, both Medicare and Medicaid and the private insurers, you know, with some difference or lack of uniformity, they are reimbursing for telemedicine. The question posed is, will, after the pandemic or the emergency subsides, will that continue? Probably with the government payers, it will be difficult to go back. With the private payers, it's not quite as clear. And that is another argument for why a set of rules and a requirement of reimbursement should be put into the law going forward.
Well, let's talk about that. Governor Wolf last April vetoed a bill that would have required insurance companies to pay for telemedicine. Now, the reason was that it banned payment for doctors prescribing an abortion drug. So right now, is it accurate to say there is little state government guidance? And obviously, from what you're saying, more is needed, correct?
That's true. I mean, there are rules and regulations around telemedicine, both at the federal and the state level. But on the question of what it is, meaning what is telemedicine, on guaranteeing that it be provided by a licensed practitioner, and then also mandating it that it be reimbursed, meaning paid for by the payers, there isn't permanent law on the books of Pennsylvania, and our members believe there should be.
Well, one thing that you mentioned, you were talking about the difference between private insurers and government insurers, that right now Medicare, the federal program, will pay for telemedicine, but that is during what has been declared an emergency by Governor Wolf. If that emergency goes away, does that mean Medicare will stop paying or not pay as much for telemedicine visits?
So the Scott, the federal rules are, I think, a little bit more complicated than that, and they're also from federal power. So I can't say as I sit here that if the governor's disaster declaration ended, that would mean that the waivers the federal government has provided for telemedicine and Medicare will also immediately go away. I can't say that. But there is a risk because all of these changes are based on the pandemic, that once the pandemic ends, you know, whether that's a decision by the federal or the state government, that the payment for it and the availability of it will, will be in jeopardy. So again, just restating this, that's why we think here in Pennsylvania, we ought to have a law that says that telemedicine, appropriately defined, will be reimbursed.
Payment parity. Insurance companies, what you're looking for, insurance companies pay the same rate as doctor's visits. I say what you're looking for. This is one of the things that I know the Pennsylvania Medical Society has been asking for. Tell me about payment parity, and is it something that that you think should be in that legislation?
So the legislation that the Hospital Association, you know, on behalf of many of its members, in fact, all of its members, says that reimbursement should occur. It does not use the term parity. And Scott, as you know, you mentioned the governor's veto on one issue of the bill that got onto his desk maybe 8 months ago, 6 months ago. You know, making legislation that will pass both chambers and get the governor's signature is a challenge. So the legislation we have supported recently says that reimbursement will occur for telemedicine. That is what it says.
Mm-hmm. But the word parity is not used. But I mean, I would assume that you're looking for, your association is looking for the same amount of payment that you would get if a visit was in person.
So, Scott, we are supporting legislation, and I don't think Senator Vogel has yet reintroduced the bill, but I believe he is about to. We are pushing for legislation that requires reimbursement.
It doesn't mention rates and any or anything like that. Okay, we have a Dr. Baker. I'm going to address this to put this one to you. David says, please discuss the technology of telehealth. In my admittedly very limited experience as a telehealth patient, my appointment with was hampered by poor audio and inconsistent readings from my at-home blood pressure device. Is technology an issue here? I mean, it would seem as though if you're going to do this, that you need quality technology.
Sure. And that is an aspect we're taking very seriously. In fact, for many people with their first visit, we actually have a technology visit ahead of time just to work on those aspects. But I suspect this will continue to progress because we've seen that this works and it provides a more convenient way of getting high quality health care for us. Occasionally we see problems, but over 85% of our visits go absolutely fine with no technical impediments. And, you know, I do want to thank, you know, the world of grandchildren out there that have helped connect their grandparents, because we're also seeing that there's really no age limit for telehealth. We've had people quite literally up to 99 years old who've been able to connect and have telehealth visits. So it's getting better, and we're working through those technical challenges.
You know, I laugh a little bit because it just my own experience. You know, I have heard some people who have maybe not been on board with telemedicine, and most of them seem to be older. And I don't want to have a stereotype here, but I think that, you know, for 60, 70, 80 years, they've seen a doctor in person, and now, you know, they're not. Without stereotyping, is that the age group that seems to be a little more hesitant to this?
I'm not sure I would want to stereotype that, though your facility with technology may be part of this. What we are finding, though, is that people who've had their first technical experience of a video visit tend to like it a lot more than they thought they were going to. And that's why we really encourage people to give it a try, because it does open up a host of convenient opportunities for you to connect with your healthcare providing team without having to get in the car or get on a bus and get over there.
We're almost out of time. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. So, Dr. Baker, what does the future look like for telemedicine?
I think it's extremely bright, and I hope we are going to see continued advances with technology connecting and the ability for diseases to be managed through telehealth with in-person visits only when it's really necessary, so that people can spend more of their time enjoying their lives and taking those steps ahead that keep them healthy. That's what we're here for, and we're trying to meet people where they are and offer them the services they need where they are.
Dr. Hal Baker with WellSpan Health, Warren Kempf with the Hospital and Health System Association of Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and before we get back into our conversation, I want to remind you about a special event that's coming up later this week on Thursday. Join Smart Talk for a virtual watch party to discuss career and technical education in the Mid-State. The watch party streams live on WITF's YouTube channel and broadcasts live on WITF 89.5 and 93.3 this Thursday at 9 a.m. during a regular program. February is Career and Technical Education Month. Smart Talk celebrates CTE trades, plus examines how teachers and students in the hands-on learning environment have been affected during the pandemic. CTE jobs are on the front lines. They're the essential workers: plumbers, EMTs, food service, law enforcement, truck drivers, and so much more. We'll discuss the important role these professions play for our infrastructure and economy during the pandemic and beyond. You can submit questions ahead of time to smarttalk@witf.org. But if you'd like to participate in the watch party, actually get to see what's going on during the show rather than just hearing it, go to witf.org/events and you can sign up for that. That's coming up on Thursday. We're looking forward to that. You know, it seems like there's an app for everything these days, and on average, mobile users in the U.S. have at least 20 that they use on a regular basis. The majority of Americans have cell phones, and nearly three-quarters of the population own a tablet or a computer. So health providers are finding opportunities to reach people where they are on their devices. Capital Blue Cross recently launched NeuroFlow, a self-guided mobile app that focuses specifically on mental health wellness. Joining us now is Dr. Jennifer Chambers, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer with Capital Blue Cross. Dr. Chambers, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Scott. How are you today?
I am doing well. Full disclosure, Capital Blue Cross is a financial supporter of Smart Talk. And if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. So, Dr. Chambers, Capital Blue Cross just launched this mental health application for mobile devices. Tell us why you felt this was necessary, especially right now.
Well, we actually have had a mental wellness telehealth service availability since long before the pandemic through the Capital Blue Cross Virtual Care app. And our latest offering, the NeuroFlow app that you've mentioned, really builds on that effort. And it's notable for the fact that our virtual care app is notable for the fact that it offers psychologists, psychiatrists, and counselors, in addition to physicians, the opportunity to connect with a patient virtually. And so during the pandemic, we felt that this was really an important offering. We have had the behavioral health aspect of virtual care up and running for a couple of years, recognizing that there was a growing epidemic in behavioral health need before the pandemic even hit. So when we deployed the NeuroFlow app in December, it was really meant to be an opportunity for a person to have a self-guided opportunity to manage their mental wellness. And they can do this independently on their own by using the different services within the app, or they can use it in between visits with a counselor, for example, so that they can follow up on reading or homework or journaling, whatever, in between their visits with their counseling professional. In terms of why now? Well, I would say that we've really recognized for a while the need for mental wellness resources that need to be readily accessible through telehealth. Access has been an issue for a number of years. And as you know, as we've talked about in the past, you know, prior to the pandemic, we were seeing epidemic rates of drug overdose, substance use disorders. We were seeing a lot of people struggling with anxiety and depression. And really, the pandemic has just really built upon that need because folks are really struggling during this time. During 2020, you can imagine isolation, financial hardship, loss of a loved one has just really dramatically increase the need for us to provide virtual options and, frankly, access to care for our members.
Dramatically increase the need for services that way. Could you explain that a little bit more? I mean, I'm not looking for numbers so much as maybe you could just talk about all the things you laid out there. We all know, if we haven't experienced it ourselves, we know someone who probably has depression, anxiety, that isolation. But in what ways have you seen that amongst your members, that it has dramatically increased the need for mental health services?
Well, for example, our virtual care app, which was deployed a couple of years ago, really had not a lot of engagement on the behavioral health side until 2020. And suddenly, as we saw the medical visits increasing virtually, as we all know through telehealth, we started to see an increase in the behavioral health services being accessed. And frankly, they have now surpassed the medical visits, and we are seeing a decline in medical visits virtually on our app, but we are seeing a continued upward trend in behavioral health visits. Another point of reference I will say is that when I look at our population health data routinely, and in years past, I will say that depression and anxiety were among the top 10, of diagnoses prevalent in our population. Now they are easily in the top 5, and in some of our businesses, it's in the top 3. So we know that from a national trend, also there's, for example, JAMA just published an article in 2020 that showed a 3-fold increase in the prevalence of mental health conditions that were relevant, that people really needed services to help support them through that. So our own data, the data that we're seeing in the use of services, and then nationally from very reputable sources, we're seeing a continued need based on the frequency that we're seeing behavioral health diagnosis. In particular, depression and anxiety are among the highest.
In our last segment on telemedicine, I asked this question, about stigma. As you well know, Dr. Chambers, this is one of the hurdles for many people to seek help with anxiety or with depression. Does this app, does telemedicine help people, or maybe take away some of that stigma and maybe help people where they'll be more apt to, that's apt with a T, more apt to seek some help, whether it's through an app or other ways?
Yeah, I will say, and I think that you and I have even talked about this in the past, that, the mental health, unwarranted stigma around mental health conditions is, it makes me very angry. It is unfortunate at best, and really deters people from seeking help that they need. Hence, a couple years ago, we were seeing suicides at an epidemic level. Really, it's unfortunate, but really terrible that we have stigma associated with mental health conditions. I do think, though, that by offering mental wellness resources, virtual care, the app through Neuroflow, will probably be very helpful in encouraging people to access care. They may be feeling more comfortable because they're doing this from the privacy of their own home. With the app, they can do this at their own pace and on their own terms. And so I think that we're working to kind of go around the stigma that way. But I still think that as a society, as a community, we need to take this head on and just really work hard to eliminate that stigma. And let's get real. This has been a really stressful time. In 2020, I think the stress levels are beyond anything that is in our historic memory as a population. So really think that this is a way for us to get to that. But I still feel very strongly we need to directly hit the stigma issue in order to get to a better place.
With Neuroflow, how does it work, Dr. Chambers? I mean, you've touched on a few of the things that it does, but how can it actually help people?
Well, it's a self-guided app. So the person who downloads the app and looks at the different services that are within the app has some control. And I think that And particularly in the behavioral health world, you know, people want to have some sense of control. And so looking at what are the services I can access through this app, and what do I want to access through this app? When am I ready to do that work is really on their own terms then. And so it offers that opportunity to for us to meet people where they are first. And then it's more holistic than just simply an app where you work just on a particular diagnosis. For example, we're looking for a holistic approach to helping people. And I've often said, and you can ask any of my team members, that I say we don't understand all of the mind-body connections. And we know some of them, but we're simply not, I guess, smart enough yet scientifically to understand how we're all wired. But we know that if we have a behavioral health condition, that can impact our physical health, and vice versa. Physical conditions, chronic conditions can lead to behavioral health challenges. And so by using a more holistic approach in the app, for example, relaxation, exercise, breathing exercises, et cetera, you're really trying to get to both and really help people to manage the symptoms that they may be experiencing physically as well as emotionally. And then what we really want to do is have people to use the app on a routine basis and then tell us how they're doing through maybe completing some questionnaires, telling us how am I feeling now with my depressive symptoms, my anxiety symptoms. And then we'll use those data with our partner NeuroFlow to continue to evolve and advance the app, because that's what we really want to do. We want to continue to improve so that we can really drive those outcomes and meet people where they are.
This NeuroFlow sounds, from what you're describing, as a tool that someone who is going through serious mental illness obviously would have to be treated by a professional. What's the link mm-hmm. between NeuroFlow, the app, and actually seeing someone for treatment?
So the app could be used in between those visits. And what I often talk about is the fact that in between those visits, people often feel that they're kind of, you know, maybe alone in their journey, that they are waiting for that next visit to report on how they're feeling, whatnot. But the app provides them with some exercises, some homework that they can agree upon with their treating provider, what they need to work on in between. And then they can actually do that work and have the opportunity to improve their symptoms so that when they go back to their next visit, they talk about their symptoms, they can continue to work on, well, what next with the app? What else can I be working on in between this and my next visit? So there is an opportunity to use the app in conjunction with those visits, either virtual or in person with a counselor. So I think that the app provides both opportunities, both a self-directed opportunity, as well as those in between those counseling visits to be able to monitor and improve on some of their symptoms.
So obviously this is something that is available to Capital Blue Cross subscribers. How do your subscribers, how do they access the app?
Well, those that are eligible, so we're starting out with certain of our small groups and insured members, and we're planning very much to expand access to the app beyond that. But we just started in December, so we're still early in this journey. But they'll receive the information on how to download the app and then register within the app. And we try to gather some early information on ways that we can help them. So it's a way for people to easily download and engage. It is not complicated at all. It is as simple as downloading the app as you would any other app off the App Store.
Dr. Jennifer Chambers is Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer with Capital Blue Cross. Dr. Chambers, always good talking with you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
And good to talk to you as well. Thank you.
Speaking of mental health, it's a good time to bring up that on tomorrow's show, we're going to be focusing on suicide. You've heard a lot about suicides, whether they're increasing, especially amongst young people during the pandemic. That is coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
If the Amazon region was a country, it would be one of the world's largest carbon polluters. As trees are cut down or destroyed by fires, they release carbon into the atmosphere. There's more carbon locked in the Amazon rainforest than emitted globally over many years. A bipartisan group of seven former U.S. cabinet secretaries and climate change negotiators have organized to produce a first-ever Amazon Protection Plan. The plan is a set of policy recommendations they say will protect the Amazon and mitigate climate change. The plan, though, comes with a big price tag. Joining us is Dr. Monica DeBall, an author and senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, an adjunct lecturer and former director for Latin American Studies and Emerging Markets at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. DeBall, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
We had Dr. DeBall on a few weeks ago, just didn't have enough time to get into a lot of the issues that we wanted to, so we decided to have her back. I may ask some of the same questions. Dr. DeBall, many have heard about the loss of the rainforest in the Amazon, but probably don't realize the context of the deforestation. What's happening in the Amazon, and why is it significant to the Earth's climate?
So what's happening in the Amazon is actually a policy decision. So it's not, you know, it's not the dry season. It's not climate related. It's not none of that. It's basically human intervention, deforesting the Amazon, the biome of the Amazon region. And that in large part is a reflection of the current policies of the standing Brazilian administration. Now, the Amazon rainforest covers about 60% of Brazil's territory, and just about that much of the rainforest is in Brazil. There are, of course, other countries that have parts of the rainforest in them, but the biggest chunk of deforestation is actually happening in Brazil.
Now, when we say deforestation, obviously we mean, you know, the forest being taken away, but being taken away for what reason? I mean, what are some of the reasons that this forest is being cut down or destroyed?
So there are various reasons. There's logging, and it's illegal. So it's illegal logging activity in the Amazon. There's, you know, people just clearing land in order to either grow cattle or grow crops. And that's also illegal when it comes to the area of the rainforest. Or it could be just pure and simple land speculation, because as it happens in the Amazon, because there are many, many problems with property rights and land registration, when the land is cleared of trees, it is worth more than land with trees on it. So there are people who just go in, cut down parts of the forest, clear a certain amount of land, and use it for speculation purposes.
Now, you mentioned that 60% of the region is in Brazil, but the Amazon cuts across nine different nations. And just to give our listeners a sense of how big this is, if you look at the Amazon rainforest and you look at this region, you're talking about the same size as the entire U.S. When you say it's illegal for some of those things you mentioned, is it illegal in all those nine countries?
It pretty much is illegal in all of those nine countries. Now, some of them have better systems of monitoring what's happening in the Amazon than Brazil currently does, which is actually a shame, because Brazil used to have a state-of-the-art supervisory and monitoring process involving a lot of real-time satellite monitoring of deforestation in the Amazon. And that system was actually put together in a partnership between one of Brazil's space agencies and NASA. So the system was put together back in the 2000s. It operated great. It continues to operate really well, except it's not serving the purpose of monitoring and enforcing penalties on people who are conducting illegal activities in the Amazon, because the current Brazilian government simply doesn't care.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Monica Dabal. She's with Johns Hopkins University and has served in a lot of different roles having to do with the Amazon and having to do with the environment. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So this plan that we're going to be talking about, some of the specifics, what's the goal of the plan?
So the goal of the plan is actually to get the U.S. in some way. I mean, given that President Joe Biden and, you know, his own sort of program has mentioned his agenda, has mentioned the Amazon as one of the key aspects to look for in the climate agenda. And as he has appointed a team to look specifically at climate issues, the Amazon rainforest is at the center of this, is at the center of any global debate on climate. And therefore, the plan is to sort of get the Biden administration to commit to, you know, helping to preserve the rainforest in a more meaningful way. Because simply saying, oh, the rainforest is important and we need to direct resources to it is not enough. There has to be a firm commitment to try to address the issues. Because, of course, you know, even though a large part of the forest is in Brazil, other parts of it are in other countries, the rainforest itself is important for the entire world. So it can't be, you know, in the hands of just one government and in particular, one government that is not serving the planet well by not preserving the rainforest, as is the case at the moment.
So, in other words, the plan, the recommendations in this plan are for the U.S. to put pressure on Brazil to change its practices. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
Yes and no. I mean, there are carrots and sticks in this plan. So on the one hand, you do need some incentives. So you do need to provide, you know, the Brazilian administration with some incentives to change its practices. And that would come in the form of financial resources for rainforest preservation. There used to be, there still is, but it's just, you know, the money's gone away. There used to be such a thing called the Amazon Fund. The Amazon Fund was set up many years ago by a couple of European countries with the purpose of having resources for rainforest preservation, sustainable agriculture, and a bunch of different things that would help end deforestation, or at least halt deforestation. But the monies committed were just too small to have any sort of impact. So the idea here is to have resources devoted to this purpose, not necessarily via the recreation of the Amazon Fund, but something that is actually more enforceable in a way than the Amazon Fund ever was. So that's the carrot side of it. Now, the stick side of it is, of course, to get the Brazilian government to commit. And in order to get the Brazilian government to commit, if there's no agreement, and at the moment there is no agreement because the Brazilian government isn't really doing anything, you need to have, you know, some sort of credible threat that is directly related to actions that might be taken if the Brazilian government does not abide by, you know, certain preservation initiatives. So, for example, you know, there are many things in the plan that look towards sustainable agriculture, sustainable trade, things of that sort. And for that, you need the commitment of the government to enforce its own environmental laws, to rebuild their environmental agency. So the agencies responsible for supervision and monitoring of deforestation. And if the government fails to do that, then obviously there could be sanctions in the form of, you know, products that are currently being made in regions that are very close to areas of deforestation or might even be involved in deforestation, then those products won't be bought by other countries, namely the US and others. Europe is already doing this with certain Brazilian exporters who are not abiding by environmental standards.
What kind of products are we talking about?
We're talking about agricultural products. So we're talking about mainly soy and all sorts of different kinds of meat, because those are the chief products that are produced in those areas.
You know, looking at the recommendations, one of them is, and you're touching on this a little bit, that the administration should strive to make sure that U.S. companies, investors, consumers, and capital markets do not contribute to Amazon deforestation. So what kind of recommendations are you talking about there?
So there is, you know, that's the enforcement aspect. That's the sort of stick aspect. So this is, you know, if there is evidence that, for example, U.S. companies are buying soy or other grains from areas in Brazil where there's deforestation going on, then those purchases should stop.
You also, you mentioned that Europe is already doing this, but the recommendations encourage the Biden administration to strengthen international alliances to turn protecting the Amazon into a true global priority. Earlier, you said that, you know, you were talking about the Biden administration has actually pointed out that the Amazon is important. The Biden administration, President Biden, early on has talked about what he wants to do to try to mitigate, to slow down the effects of climate change. You know, the United States has rejoined the Paris Agreement now. But why is it important that this become, it sounds like what you're looking for is a worldwide agreement here.
Yeah, that's what we need. So when, before the Biden administration, so during the Trump administration, the levels of deforestation in the Amazon went up. This coincided with the current Brazilian president being elected. So the years 2019 and 2020 were the highest years on record in deforestation. And this is looking at the entire history. So the Amazon deforestation issue has been a problem since the 1970s. It had gone up steadily until about 2004, when the current Brazilian government decided to take action. Deforestation went down until about 2011, 2012. It stabilized, it started going back up in 2015. And then in 2019 and 2020, it really took off. And at that time, a lot of European countries were actually trying to put together these sorts of export sanctions or import sanctions, if you will, on Brazilian products because of, you know, there was a major outcry with respect to deforestation. The U.S. did not join those efforts under Trump. However, it is now extremely important, especially given the importance that Joe Biden had given to the Amazon and the role it plays in climate change. It is of paramount importance that the U.S. join these efforts in trying to stem deforestation in the region. So yes, there needs to be wide cooperation between the U.S. and other countries in whatever approach is taken towards the Brazilian administration in the Amazon issue.
So you made these recommendations, and I assume that they've made their way to the Biden administration. What have you heard? What kind of progress has been made? What's the future look like?
So we're sort of in a wait and see mode. We do know that the Biden administration has reached out, namely John Kerry has reached out to Brazilian authorities. They've had a first round of conversations. I gather that first round of conversations was relatively unproductive. The approach taken was more of a conciliatory approach, trying to sort of build a bridge with the Bolsonaro administration. But it's going to be very hard to do that because these are on the other side. So on the Brazilian side, the people that are responsible for dealing with climate issues, with the exception of the president himself, we're talking about the sort of equivalent of the head of the State Department. So the foreign relations minister on the one hand and the environmental minister on the other. And both of those people have been responsible for the dismantling of the supervisory and monitoring agencies, climate agencies in Brazil. And they've also been responsible for, you know, just allowing the environmental laws not to be met. So these are not exactly the people who are going to be helpful in a conversation like this. So at the moment, I see things in a sort of an impasse, and it's really not clear yet what sort of next step the Biden administration is going to take, whether it's going to increase or up the tone with respect to the Brazilians, or whether it's going to continue trying to find some kind of diplomatic grounds upon which to work. It's just not clear. Being a Brazilian and knowing exactly who the other side is, who composes the other side and what they're like, I find it very hard that there will be a diplomatic solution.
Dr. Monica DeBall, I want to thank you very much for talking about this. Doesn't get a lot of attention in the United States, and it probably will get more. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.